Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Dr. David G. Schwartz, gaming historian, affiliate professor of history at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, along with being an administrator at UNLV. We'll be discussing his new book, At the Sands, which covers the Sands Casino from its inception to its implosion. David Schwartz, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me.
So this is your third or fourth visit. Why did you choose to write about the Sands?
Well, the Sands is really the classic Las Vegas casino with the most mystique. I think when most people think about classic Las Vegas, about the Rat Pack era, they think about the Sands because that's where the Rat formed, in the Coppola Room. So that was really what drew me to the book. It's just the quintessential classic Las Vegas casino.
Now, a previous book was called The Grandissimo, First Emperor of Las Vegas. That was a biography of Jay Sarno and talks about the creation of Caesar's Palace and Circus Circus, among other things. That book was timed approximately during the middle half of the Sands 40-year run. And some of the same characters, like Frank Sinatra and various mob figures, figure in both books. Is it easier for you to go back to approximately the same era for another book, or does it matter much?
It doesn't really matter. You know, as a historian, I'm, you know, trained to look at all different time periods. So it's, you know, in some ways it might be easier because you have a grasp of it. In other ways, I think it's more limiting because you have to try to find new things to say, whereas looking at a different period, you kind of have a whole new world there. And what I like about this book with At the Sands is, you know, starts in 1952, ends in 1996. So I haven't been able to write in depth quite so much about the 80s and 90s, but I was able to do a little bit of that in this book.
All right. So,
I mean, that was, I just want to say, that was a period of tremendous change in Las Vegas. So, yeah, I think it's a good era to be talking about.
And it was, on a personal basis, I started coming semi-regularly in '80s, and in the '90s I moved here, so I have my own Sand stories. How long was the mob probably affiliated with the Sands?
Well, again, you know, looking at the mob, it's a little bit harder to do the research on that than it is in other things, because obviously by definition they don't really leave a lot of records, and you're not going to have a written accord saying we the mob hereby affiliate ourselves with the Sands as of this date. But, you know, if you look at it, look at the people behind it, definitely from the time it started, there was that influence there. You had people involved with it who had those connections. Probably that ends when Howard Hughes bought it in 1967.
All right. We'll talk about Howard Hughes later. The Sands' prominence began with Jack and Trotter and Carl Cohen. Names I was unfamiliar with until I read the book. Tell us about them.
Sure, I'd love to. You know, Jack and Trotter was the vice president, almost said vice provost there, thinking about my day job and dealing with the provost's office there. He was the vice president of entertainment and basically came out from the Copacabana in New York City to run entertainment for the Sands, to set the policy and to run the Copa Room. And he had this idea that you make the Sands the place where everybody wants to perform, and then it will be the place that people want to go to see the acts. So he was successful in this, and they didn't always pay as much as other casinos did, but there is this extra level of prestige where if you performed at the Sands, your agent could then go around to the nightclubs around the country and say, well, hey, you know, my guy's coming fresh off a stint at the Sands. You've got to treat him a little bit better, and they would be able to get more money. So it was good for that. If you look at the Sands architecturally, it was not a very striking building. You know, in the original years, it was two-story, pretty much motels, glorified motel rooms, very unpretentious building. the entertainment was what gave it an identity. And that was what really drew people. And of course, in those days, it wasn't enough to make the Sands a household name. Although Jack and Trotter did that, Al Freeman, the PR director, had a tremendous role in that too. You had to have entertainment that appealed to the gamblers. And that is another thing that Jack and Trotter was really good at. You know, he didn't take everybody who wanted to play the Sands didn't play the Sands because they wouldn't appeal to their customers. So he was good at that too. Carl Cohen has one of the best reputations I've ever seen in the history of casinos in Las Vegas. You know, through the years, talking with people who know the business and know the business historically, including Jack Binion and Steve Wynn, you know, they both have separately said this to me in the past. Carl Cohen was the greatest casino manager of all time, in their estimation, because he was able to not only protect the games. We not only knew that aspect of being a casino manager, and I realize now I'm talking to some guys who are coming at it from the other aspect. You know? So he's not able to do that, but he's also able to work with the customers and be, you know, for lack of a better word, schmooze them, but to just, he seems like the kind of person, and this is, would describe somebody who was in Roll the Bones, who could tell you to go to hell in such a way that you would be looking forward to the trip.
Huh.
So, you know, so when he's got to give you the hard news of, yeah, we can't give you any more credit, you know, no, we need you to pay that marker. He's able to do it in such a way that it wouldn't alienate the high roller, you know, wouldn't alienate him and wouldn't drive him away, which is a real talent.
Actually, one of the things that I found just shocking was, I'm skipping ahead a bit here, but when Hughes took over in the 60s and suddenly the bean counters came in and they wanted the names of the players to give mm-hmm. them credit. And the players were like, I'm not going to tell the casino my name. And so it was astounding to me that they were giving credit to people without even knowing their name. How do they do that?
They knew it, but they didn't know it. You know, so let's say that you were a big player. You know, first of all, there is it's a small community of big players in those days where they're going to know everybody. You know, it was a very niche field, I guess you would say. So if you're a known player, you're going to have a reputation. And, you know, you're not just going to show up with a bunch of money, especially if you're, you know, at that level, you know, where you're getting markers. Clearly you have a relationship with somebody where they can collect that marker. It's not that nobody knew their name. It's that they had never wrote their name down. And when you came to the Sands, you know, it might be somebody who had a position in finance. You know, maybe they were a bank president, where it wouldn't be to their benefit to have their name publicized as, hey, this person is gambling here. So they would just be, and I know that you guys have seen this, you know, it's that classic question of how do you balance privacy with respect? You know, so instead of being, oh, welcome, hello, Mr. Dancer or Mr. Munchkin, it's so good to see you, you're Mr. D or Mr. M.
Yeah.
They're respecting you, but they're not blaring your name around. You know, that's what that was about, where they would never write their names down. Of course they knew who they were. They were just, you know, for the purposes of that evening, they were Mr. D. When they stayed in the hotel, they may be staying under a different name. And these were the players who didn't want to have to basically formally give their name and sign in.
You know, before they changed the laws that made markers legally collectible, I knew a guy in the 80s who his title at the Sands was host, but his job was to fly to wherever you lived if you had an unpaid marker and show up and knock on your door and say, I'm here to collect the marker. And I mean, he was not a guy you wanted to argue with. And I mean, that was well into the 80s that he was still doing that.
I heard a great story from somebody else, not with the Sands, with another casino, who basically told me a story about how he drove down to Seal Beach, California, and stopped in Barstow and said, hey, I'm driving down there And by the time I get down there, you really should have the money. And that was all he said. He didn't threaten him. And this was a big guy. This is a big cowboy guy. And, you know, he said, didn't threaten him. Didn't just said, yeah, I'm driving there. I'm about halfway there. And by the time I get down there, I want to see the money. So yeah, that was, yes, that's entirely consistent with it. But, you know, it's important to say it wasn't just the threat of force. It was their standing. You know, the gamblers viewed this as a badge of honor that they would pay their debts, that they'd pay their markers off. So, you know, in some ways that would be worse. It's okay, you don't have to pay it, but then we're going to put it out there. And I love the thing, you know, Edward Walters, who was a pit boss there, told me the story about Carl Cohen saying, you know, the first one, you know, when somebody tries to take a shot or says, yeah, you know, my marker was for 20 grand, not 30 grand. He supposedly Carl Cohen would sit you down and say, the first one we'll give you. You can have the first one. Second one, we'll have a conversation, and there's not going to be a third one. And yeah, that was pretty much how they did it. Which is, to me, that's good management. You know, if you tell your players, like, yeah, if you want to call, if you want to take shots at us or something, like, we'll give you one, but pick which one you want. Anyway, this may be why I didn't go into a career as a casino manager, because that might not be the best policy.
It would nice to be know that going in, that, the first 100,000 I don't have to pay. Okay, good.
Yeah.
That would,
yeah. Well, it's not that they wouldn't have to pay it. It's if you just kind of beefed and said, well, it wasn't for as much as, you know, because of course there were no records for this. They would just say, hey, is he good for $40,000? Yeah, he's good. And they wouldn't write that down. And then when you settle up, well, yeah, we gave you 40 in chips. No, I remember it was 30. And you know, of course, nowadays that would never happen because everything is documented. But back then it was really a thing about their word. And, you know, it was important to them.
Now, as you said, when the Sands was built, it was definitely low rise with a lot of two-story buildings spread out all over the place. But eventually it became high rise. When did this happen and why?
So in the early 60s, 1962, they add the Aqueduct Suites, which was really, it was three stories, and it was that sort of curved, in that curve there, kind of recalling maybe a little bit the Fountain Blue in Miami. And this was seen as, okay, now we're really competing with the Desert Inn and other places for these luxury, you know, luxury suites. And this was seen as really top-notch stuff. They still didn't have that mass market, though, so they added the tower in 65, 66. They add the tower, which added another couple hundred rooms, which brought them up to about 777 rooms total. So by today's standards, still very small. By 1966 standards, on the smaller side, you know, this is when the Riviera is adding a ton of rooms. You know, Stardust has over 1,000 rooms already. Dunes is adding, they have the tower there, the Diamond of the Dunes. So the other casinos are expanding at this time, and Sands is barely keeping up.
Tell us about Frank Sinatra's presence at the Sands, and it's all right to spend 10 minutes on this if you like.
Sure. And feel free to interrupt me, and because I really prefer the conversation and the monologue. I don't want to feel like I'm lecturing or something. So Sinatra is a bit, I think that's the textbook definition of a mixed blessing or a double-edged sword. On one hand, when he started playing there in 1953, he really brought a new level of visibility to the Sands. You know, on the other, there's a lot that comes with that. You know, he had a lot of demands. When the Sands opened, the opening headliner was Danny Thomas. And for years, Danny Thomas was the go-to guy. When they had their anniversary party every December, they'd bring Danny Thomas in. And Frank Sinatra was, with him, was the face of the Sands. He was sort of the one they would put out there for the cool stuff, where Danny Thomas would be sort of the ceremonial face of the Sands. So Sinatra, from 53 onward, was really deeply tied to it. And I'm going to branch out into the Rat Pack a little bit. Sammy Davis Jr. starts playing the Sands in 55 together with Jerry Lewis. And then they split shortly afterwards. And in the divorce, I guess, Dean gets custody of the Sands, and Dean stays at the Sands and keeps playing there and does that for many years. And then Sammy comes along in 57, and they're all playing separately. There are a couple other interesting things that happened as far as the Rat Pack goes, and I'm going to focus on them for a minute. In 50, I think it was in 58, it might have been 59, Judy Garland opened at the Sands, and this was considered a huge story. They chartered a train to bring people up from L.A. to see her opening night, and Frank Sinatra got up for about 20 minutes in her opening night and did and performed with her. So, and you would see this over the years where, hey, you know, Sammy's performing, Frank is in town, so he'll come up for a song or two. It wasn't until January of 1960, when they were filming Ocean's 11, that Al Freeman, who was the PR director, got the idea of, hey, we've got these guys in town, let's put them all on the bill together, and this will be the greatest show in the history of entertainment. And that's how they build it, and that's how people accepted it. And that was really the genesis of the Rat Pack. So it's almost like a story. They were an overnight success after years of performing. You know, they came together overnight, but the individual people have been playing there for years.
And how did the Rat Pack come about?
That is fascinating. So the Rat Pack. So today we all call them the Rat Pack. At the time, they hated that name. Frank Sinatra hated the name the Rat Pack. So supposedly, it was a group of people who hung around with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, and Frank Sinatra was part of that deal. And then they later gave it to the Vegas version, too. It was Dorothy Kilgallen, who was a gossip columnist, who Frank Sinatra hated with a passion, you know, viciously. And he, you know, Frank was not shy. If he didn't like somebody, he was not shy. And he, I mean, said some terrible things about her on stage, just really cruel. Although she gave it to him too, so I guess it's only fair. But she used that term, and he hated it. The Sands never said Rat Pack. You know, they called it the Summit. So sort of like the Summit with Khrushchev and Eisenhower, they called it the Summit. They never called it the Rat Pack. They tried to make calling it the Klan a thing, but Sammy didn't like that because if you spell it with a K instead of a C, it doesn't really go over well. And I'm sure the Klan, you know, if they spelled it with a K, the Klan probably would have filed for copyright or something with, you know, two Italian guys and a black guy calling themselves the Klan wouldn't go over well. And you got Joey Bishop in the mix too. So that would, you know, kind of
would
disqualify them a lot of counts. So they usually just called it the Summit. You know, looking back at the newspapers and magazines in the 60s, they called it the Summit. They called it Frank Sinatra and Friends. It's not until the 80s that you see people call it the Rat Pack.
Isn't there kind of a famous picture where the Sands sign has the Rat Pack on it?
It has all their names, but it doesn't say the Rat Pack.
Ah, okay.
It just says Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy. It just has all their names. And that, you know, that was from Ocean's 11. Where Sinatra had complete control, so he wouldn't have done that. But it doesn't say Rat Pack. And yeah, he hated that. And you were not quite as the Bugsy Siegel, Ben Siegel thing, where Ben Siegel didn't want to be called Bugsy. But Sinatra did not like the Rat Pack. You know, basically, if you said that, they looked down on you like you're an outsider. That's not what we call it. Then, you know, they pretty much officially was Frank Sinatra and Friends. And there's a great picture in UNLV Special Collections and Archives, photo collections. It says, you know, Dean Martin with his Italian friend Francis. That's how it was billed there. You know, so there is lots of different iterations of it. But yeah, they didn't call it the Rat Pack, although we do. You know, and I put that in the. So the question is, well, am I a total poser? Because I put that in my book subtitle. And, you know, my answer is, well, that's how people know it. So if I said, you know, the casino that brought the Summit together, people would have no, you know, that is the sound of people not understanding what you're saying. So Rat Pack, people know. So that's why I put Rat Pack in the title.
So far, everything about Frank Sinatra has been good for the Sands.
Yeah.
Later on, he became a pain in the ass.
Frank is one of the most gifted vocal artists of the 20th century. I mean, you can't really dispute that. And with that, there's a certain level of entitlement, I guess you would say. Also, on a personal level, he just had a more conflict-prone personality. than, let's say, Sammy Davis Jr. or definitely Dean Martin. I mean, Dean Martin was really beloved by people at the Sands because he was so easy to get along with. You know, basically, and Dean Martin's thing was like, hey, show me, where's my mark? You know, where do you want me to stand? What do you want me to say? I'll do it. And then I want to go play golf. That was pretty much his thing. You know, he didn't have quite that overwhelming ambition that Sinatra did, which obviously brought him into conflict. You know, found an interesting memo, sort of stream of memos in the Special Collections and Archives Sands collection, where Al Freeman is going back and forth with some of Sinatra's representatives. You know, Sinatra also by this point was a part owner of the Sands. He had an 11% share. So he felt like he literally owned the place, so he could do what he wanted. So apparently at one point he arranged to have a contest where DJs nationwide would pick somebody to stay in the Sands. And the grand prize was a free weekend in the Sands. And Al Freeman says, hey, look, you know, it's a busy weekend. We're giving up the room. What are you doing here? And they said, well, you know, Frank is paying for the airplane. He's paying the airfare, and you're just giving up the room and the food. And, you know, Frank would really like this to happen. And it's clear, and just back and forth, there's some very passive aggressive stuff there where it's very clear that they're not all overjoyed with Frank. You know, Frank also made enemies and had some of the wrong friends. And in particular, one of the things I go into detail in the book is he had a falling out with the Kennedys over his friendship with Sam Giancana. Frank was also the majority owner of the Cal Neva up in Tahoe and was hosting Sam Giancana there. And Sam Giancana was on the black book, the list of excluded persons, when he shouldn't have been allowed in any casino. And that got back to Gaming Control Board. They confronted him over with it, and he ended up surrendering his license over it. So that put him out of the Sands as an owner. And in the FBI file of Carl Cohen, which I got a chance to see, there was a line in there. One of the informants of the FBI claimed that they were at a meeting of the Sands executives, and the Sands executives said they were like, we are making no heroic efforts to help Frank Sinatra out with his license. Like, he got into this problem, you know, sorry, you know, it's his misfortune, none of our own. That's pretty much was their feeling. And that was kind of played out that way.
All right. Later on, he got back in a little bit.
Yeah. So that was 63 when he lost his ownership. In 67, he stops performing there, and that's a whole other story there. And that's when he leaves the Sands.
For good.
Yeah. Before it was as an owner, but he was still performing. After 67, he doesn't perform there. He goes to Caesars. And it's kind of funny because he had an altercation at the Sands with Carl Cohen. Then he goes to Caesars. That was in 67. Then Caesars in 1970 there, Sandy Waterman, who had been at the Sands and had been his partner up in the Cal Neva, pulled a gun on him. So it's kind of funny.
He went to get punched.
On Sinatra, yeah. This was front page news, and the sheriff, Ralph Lamb, was involved and said, they investigated it, and they said, look, you know, if Sinatra wants to cause trouble, he's not, you know, we're not going to let him do that. He doesn't get away with that. So, yeah, so he, you know, if you want to think of epic rivalries like, you know, RFK and Jimmy Hoffa, Frank Sinatra and casino managers and Frank Sinatra and the media are two of them.
Well, that would be kind a good of a book. That's kind of a famous story about his altercation with Carl Cohen in the Sands. Do you want to tell that?
Yeah, and this, you know, I think this, to me, the lesson I take from this, because of course, why study the past unless we're learning something, is Carl Cohen, like I said, just has the respect of people, a lifetime of discipline, of sweet-talking customers, of diffusing situations, and in one split second, he lost patience and punched Frank Sinatra, and that is what he's remembered for. Yeah. In his obituary, it's amazing. You know, basically, and I go through this in great detail in the book, but basically, Sinatra had his credit cut off. He didn't like it. There's a confrontation with Cohen. He said some words to Cohen. He flipped a table on him and spilled hot coffee on him, and Cohen, out of pure instinct, again, this was a guy who came up from the streets, punched him, knocked two of the caps off his teeth, About 3 hours later, Caesar's Palace announces that Frank Sinatra has signed a contract with them to perform there for several years. So my own interpretation is that the split was there's probably some premeditation in it. I don't just think that Frank Sinatra decided to be difficult for the sake of being difficult. And I think we've all kind of bought into the hype a little bit. Like, clearly he had already negotiated with Caesars. You know, I don't think though that him getting punched in the face by Carl Cohen was part of the plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think there's definitely something going on behind the scenes there, because you see him leave, you see a lot of high rollers go to the Sands, and then you also see people like Sandy Waterman go to the Sands. So there's definitely something going on there.
You mean to Caesars?
To Caesars, yeah, from the Sands.
Now, when Sammy Davis Jr. started playing at the Sands, he couldn't have a room there or stay there because he was black.
Yes. Or eat in the restaurants.
Yeah. This was never a state policy. It never was in the law. It was de facto segregation. And this was up and down the strip and downtown Las Vegas. Black Americans were not welcome as guests. They were welcome as performers. And it's kind of interesting, too. If you look at the initial run of people at the Sands, you've got Danny Thomas. Then you've got Lena Horne. Billy Eckstein, a couple other people. So they were performing there from the start, but the idea was they were allowed to perform. They didn't stay there. They would stay at a boarding house on the west side. And as the 50s goes on, this liberalizes a little bit, where Sammy Davis Jr. would stay there, but the people who played in his band, if they were black, would stay in the west side. And even by 58, 59, Sammy Davis Jr. is going out on the casino floor, although, you know, if you're a black doctor or lawyer and want to come in and spend your money, they're not going to let you in. So that's kind of how it started changing. But in 1960, the local NAACP threatened to have a protest on the strip and basically threatened to not boycott, because they already weren't allowed to be customers there, but to have picket lines in the strip. And this would mean that any conventions that came in would have to cross the picket lines. And also any black employees or entertainers would have to cross the NAACP picket line. And they didn't want to see that, so they compromised very quickly and said that they would desegregate the strip in downtown, which they did.
And that happened in what year?
1960. So it's interesting. It's March 26th.
I thought it was later than that.
March 26, 1960 was when they announced the Moulin Rouge Agreement. And that, it's interesting, because if you look at Ocean's 11, in Ocean's 11, Sammy Davis Jr.'s character isn't a performer in a nightclub like Dean Martin's character is, and he's not a gambler like some of the other ones. He's a trash truck driver, because he would not have been allowed, as a black man, he would not have been allowed in a strip casino in January of 1960. April, that's changed. So that's when that happens. And then there are, of course, that does not end years of inequity overnight. There's later a consent decree and other things like that for employment. But that starts in 1960.
Now,
Did that happen all over town pretty much at the same time?
It was. Some places dragged their feet. And for years after this, you had the NAACP sending people out to different casinos, and some casinos were definitely slower than others. I know in the course of doing the research about Sinatra's license, I was looking at a lot of the Gaming Control Board actions and stuff like that, and there was mention, I think it might have been as late as 66, 67, 68, about a casino in northern Nevada that point blank refused to desegregate. When undercover officers and people from the NAACP came in, they were denied service, and how this, you know, this was an ongoing issue that late into the late 60s. So it wasn't like the problem was solved overnight.
I've heard conflicting things about Frank Sinatra's role regarding segregation. I mean, on one hand, I heard that he was helpful, but then on another, I heard that he was not. So do you know much about that?
I've heard that he was very helpful. You know, and to the extent that early in his career, we're talking about the 40s and the 50s, he was so anti-segregation that some of the more conservative people said that he was obviously affiliated with the communists. This is one of the reasons why Howard Hughes didn't like Sinatra. He thought he was a communist sympathizer. There's a couple facts, you know, and of course you could say, well, Sammy Davis Jr. wrote all that stuff, wrote how much he loved Sinatra and how much, you know, Sinatra helped him and how supportive he was, because it was self-serving, because Sammy was, you know, needed Sinatra's patronage or whatever. You know, that's that, even if you discount what Sammy Davis Jr. said, and Davis gives Sinatra a lot of credit and said Sinatra never wavered, and he made it clear, if Sammy doesn't come in, I don't come in. And he, you know, Davis is adamant about that. In the late 40s, Billy Eckstein was the first black performer at the Copacabana in New York, and he desegregated that. Frank Sinatra was instrumental in getting the gig, and in his opening night, Frank Sinatra was in the crowd, and one of the patrons was saying some racially insensitive things about Billy Eckstein. Sinatra got the manager, and they kicked that guy out and said, no, you can't talk that way in here.
Wow.
That's more than a lot. You know, and certainly you could say, well, he could have done more. That's more than a lot of other people did. So he was definitely on the leading edge of that.
But in the Rat Pack shows,
The humor,
they would make fun of, he would carry Sammy Davis Jr. in as a puppet or something and make black jokes.
By today, yes. You know, and there were, Sammy Davis Jr. himself would tell the joke. He's like, hey, you know, I'm black, my mother's Puerto Rican, and I converted to Judaism. So when I move into a neighborhood, I wipe the whole thing out. There go the property values. So he, you know, that was a lot of the humor by today's standards we would not find very humorous. And, you know, probably it was not personally, I'm sure that Sammy didn't, or I would imagine that Sammy didn't like being the butt of a lot of those jokes. But, you know, at the end of the day, he wanted him on stage with him. So, yeah, I mean, by today's standards, I don't think anybody would play those recordings of the Rat Pack and say, this is our exemplar of, you know, racial sensitivity. But if you look at what he did behind the scenes, he certainly did do a lot.
Very good. We're going to take a brief commercial break, and we'll get back to talking to Professor David G. Schwartz about the Sands. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In December, the promotion of the month is half price, almost everything, including using your points, from December 14th to 24th. This includes restaurants, bars, movie, gift shops, spa, salon, and bingo. Full details at the club. You don't have to have earned the points in December. Just have them uncashed, and it counts. For gourmets among you, this is a good time to go to Michael's Restaurant. Michael's Restaurant is one of the premier steakhouses in town. It's a bit pricey, but at half price, it's an excellent value. On Christmas Day, there's a hot seat promotion where $100 in free play goes to a player every 3 minutes, starting at 8 a.m., lasting until midnight. It's been determined that the normal semester video poker classes starting in January or February has been canceled due to COVID concerns. We're optimistic that we'll be able to continue the classes in September of 2021. At Predictit.org, there's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. The election is over, we think, so a high percentage of their active markets are about who's going to win have been closed. Now there are markets on who's going to be in the cabinet and the status of various recount attempts. Gambling with an Edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predictit.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. BlackjackApprenticeship.com is an excellent site for those of you who wish to be successful at counting cards at blackjack. A free video posted on YouTube about a year ago is how much money do you need to count cards successfully? There are lots of these videos. To me, the most useful part of them is using them to determine whether you can learn from the way Colin teaches. If you can and become a member of the site, there are many, many training videos available to you on a variety of subjects. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Wheel Poker Deluxe. This is a game where you pay an extra 5 coins per game, meaning triple play costs 20 coins, 5 play costs 30 coins, 10 play costs 55 coins. And the bonuses come on dealt trips, full houses, and quads, slightly different for Deuces Wild variations. If you get one of these bonuses, you spin the wheel. When the wheel spins, it lands on a drawing opportunity. Sometimes it's 100 play, 4 to a flush. Sometimes it's 10 play with a pair of aces. Sometimes it's triple play, 4 to a royal, etc. There's no skill involved in the hold for the bonus, and the bonus is earned on the draw, meaning that if you know the strategy for the base game, you know the strategy for Wheel Poker Deluxe version, and it adds a bit of EV. Surprisingly, the triple play version always adds a bit more than the 5-play version. For example, in 9-6 double-double bonus, the base game pays 98.98%. The 5-play version of Wheel Poker Deluxe pays 99.31%, and the triple play version pays 99.47%. All right, let's get back to David Schwartz. Now, Robert Kennedy and other federal officials took a critical eye on all of Las Vegas during this era. Tell us about that and what changes were made.
Sure. So in 1960, John F. Kennedy was elected president. He named his brother Robert F. Kennedy attorney general. RFK wanted to get Jimmy Hoffa and get the mob. Those are the two people, one person, one group that he was opposed to. So they immediately shifted priorities in the Justice Department. They had squads of agents deputized from all sorts of agencies. So IRS, FBI, immigration, ATF, all that, and basically going looking for whatever they could find that would be incriminating against people in the mob, and of course against Jimmy Hoffa. And unfortunately for Vegas, that was where Jimmy Hoffa and his Teamsters Union had loaned a lot of money, and also it was known as a place where there were mob connections. So Bobby Kennelly had this plan where he was going to have federal agents raid and close down most of the casinos of the Strip and then look for evidence of the mob. And obviously that wasn't a good idea for Las Vegas or Nevada, so Governor Grant Sawyer flew out to D.C. and finally pleaded with John F. Kennedy, basically told him, like, look, if you do this, no Democrat is going to get elected in this state ever again. Like, you can't do this. And so they called that off. But still, there was a lot of suspicion from the federal government. The FBI had not just mobsters, but also Las Vegas casino executives in surveillance for many years in the early 1960s.
Now, I was surprised that because this was the era when Greenfield Jungle came out, and I was surprised you didn't get into that at all. That it didn't seem to be mentioned or brought up.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing. You know, definitely that was another book that was out at the time that was influential. But yeah, you know, got to make some decisions. And yeah, I didn't think that was really directly central to the Sands story, although certainly in a bigger history of Las Vegas at that time, it would be probably a chapter.
So, there was this big crackdown on the mobsters. This is early 60s, but really they're not gone until like the era in the movie Casino, which is early 1980s, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they did have a massive wiretapping operation that, since wiretapping is illegal in Nevada, got absolutely no evidence they could use. So they were not, you know, they never found a huge skim. The federal government in the 60s didn't find that. You know, that's not until the 70s in Straw Man that they actually get the skim. And ironically, it's not because of a wiretap in a Vegas casino. It's because, as we saw in the movie Casino in Kansas City in that grocery store.
Right.
So, you know, that's the kind of funny thing. It's nothing to do with Vegas. You basically, in the 60s through the 80s, a lot of the conditions changed. You know, a lot of the people who had been involved with gambling in the mob are getting older and retiring. And the younger people coming in aren't, you know, in organized crime. They're into narcotics. They're into stuff like that. They're not into running illegal casinos or something like that, or doing sports betting so much. So you have that change there. You also have the casinos themselves are getting much more expensive to build. You know, the Sands cost about $4.5 million to build. Caesar's Palace cost about $19 million to build. The International cost over $50 million to build. So you can't get that, and you could get that kind of money from the mob guys for the Sands. Caesars, they're really pushing it, and, you know, International, there's no way to compete. So they kind of get priced out. And there's a lot of other changes, of course. The enforcement becomes much stricter in Nevada. But there are just a lot of structural changes that dictated the mob leaving the gaming industry as owners.
Well, and Howard Hughes buying up so many places. But, you know, I got here in 77, and they were making fun, you know, the older guys running the casinos were making fun of these people who were taking over casinos that had gone to college. That was still a kind of a laughable thing that college kids were going to run casinos.
Yeah, you know, that's part of the shift, and I think UNLV played a role in that too. You know, the founding of the hospitality school, and you now had a pool of people who had that, you know, in addition to working in casinos and hotels, had that knowledge. And, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that the industry needed to get bigger. You're not going to be able to borrow $2 billion to build a casino resort and say, oh yeah, we just have people who know the business and they don't have any credentials. You know, you can't do that. So I think it's an adjustment to the size of the industry changing.
Now, we've talked about him a couple times. Howard Hughes plays a role at the Sands. So when did he come to town? When did he get the Sands?
Hughes came to town in 1966. It was Thanksgiving weekend, 1966. He felt too much scrutiny in Boston, where he had been living, and took two entire floors of the Desert Inn, St. Andrew's Tower, and decided he liked it very much, and decided when they tried to get rid of him in the run-up to New Year's Eve, they asked him politely to leave, decided to buy the place. And that was the first of many casinos he bought. He had a big chunk of money from having had to sell his shares in TWA after a lawsuit there. And he basically invested a lot of it into casinos and Nevada real estate. And that was in 67 that he was doing most of the casino purchases. So the Sands purchase closed, I believe, in the summer of 1967, early summer.
And what kind of changes did that make to the Sands?
There were some pretty big changes, you know, and again, the Sands, if you look at it, a lot of the casino had been run on a handshake basis before this. That changes. They get professional accounting in there. And in doing so, they put stricter cash controls in place. In doing so, they ran off a lot of their most favored customers. So it was probably didn't necessarily have the intended effect, but it did make it a much easier place to manage.
So when did Sheldon Adelson come along, and what changes did he make?
So the Sands, Summa Corporation, which is the successor to Howard Hughes, sells it to a group that Inns of the Americas, which was a group that owned many motels around and hotels, mostly in the Western Hemisphere. They had the idea of repositioning it. This is 1980-81, had the idea of repositioning it for the Latin American customer. You know, at the time, this looked like a great idea because Mexico's wealth was booming. There was a lot of oil wealth there. Unfortunately, a recession hit. Mexico devalued the peso and wasn't letting the money out of Mexico, and that pretty much ruined that. So Summa had to take over again. Summa took over again. They then sold it in 1988 to Kirk Kerkorian, who then, a few months later, sold it to Sheldon Adelson. And Mr. Adelson and the Interface Group bought it. They had first come to Las Vegas running the Comdex convention. That's the Computer Dealers Expo. And he realized that you make a lot of money running Comdex, but you make more money running the hotel that hosts Comdex. And, you know, Comdex at the time had over 100,000 people coming to it. It was just a gigantic convention that just stretched the limits of the city to their fullest. And he joined as a casino owner and had the idea of, instead of just tolerating convention people for filling the midweek, actually build a resort around them. And eventually what that led to was the Venetian, which meant the closure of the Sands.
And the other casinos thought they hated the convention business, right? Because the conventioners didn't gamble.
Yeah, and I think this is something that would surprise people who, you know, have a knowledge of the industry from today and Vegas from today, where, you know, at least until COVID, every casino, every hotel wants to have a healthy convention program, healthy business travel program. That's an essential part. People didn't see it that way in 1989. People didn't see it that way in Vegas. You know, one of the owners actually said, I'm glad that Mr. Adelson bought a casino because now he can see how terrible it is when Comdex comes to town. And the people were upset because, yeah, their gaming revenue went down when Comdex was in town because they had to give the rooms to the convention people. But, you know, their room rates went up, their food and beverage spending went up, everything else went up. So, you know, it was actually a very smart thing to do. And by 1999, when the Venetian opens, I think people were very open to this. And if you look around town, pretty much every major resort has a big convention component to it.
In the mid-50s, the Sands was considered elegant. Later, as she aged, she was very shabby. What happened?
I think that was a byproduct of Summa. And, you know, they were not in a position where they were investing a ton of money into their resorts, especially not the Sands. You know, the Desert Inn probably was the top tier property for Summa. And then you had Frontier kind of at the lower end and Landmark, and you had the Sands kind of in the middle.
Actually, low end was the Castaways and the Silver Slipper.
Yeah. Yeah. At the even lower end. You know, you didn't really have that TLC that it probably needed, that other places that were owned independently, like let's say the Riviera got expanded a lot, the Flamingo, Hilton invested a lot in the Flamingo and in the Hilton to expand them. You know, you didn't really see the Sands getting that kind of TLC in the 70s or the 80s. So by the time the 90s roll around, the casino really is undersized and old, and it just doesn't have enough to compete.
What year did you, the showroom close, the Copa?
So they closed it first in, I believe it was 1981, they closed it for the first time, and they made it smaller, and they switched the entertainment policy where they were going to convert it into sort of a semi-lounge and have review acts there, and then have the headliners in the celebrity theater, which originally was the celebrity ballroom, which originally was a convention space. So that was the plan. They tried it for a couple months. It didn't work out. And they brought headliners back in 1982 to the Copa Room. And then until it closed, it was pretty much a split between review acts, you know, so sort of like Viva Las Vegas, the Las Vegas show, that kind of stuff, and headliners.
You know, I just one of the things I was pleased to see in the book, as you mentioned, the day that COPA closed, in the lounge was Jerry Tiffey, who's a friend of both Bob's and mine. And yeah. I just want to say for the listeners, you know, if COVID is ever over, if you haven't heard Jerry Tiffey sing, he's at the Italian American Club on Saturdays and Sundays, just a fantastic singer.
Now, with the perspective of time, David, what do you consider to be the legacy of the Sands?
I think the legacy of the Sands is that in the 50s, they were able to build a casino and more broadly build Las Vegas as an entertainment destination. And like, hey, this is what we do here. You want to see the big stars, you come to Vegas. I think that's really the legacy. And it's probably not a way to reinvent Vegas after COVID is over, of course, because I think there's still a premium for that kind of experience.
Very good. Thank you, David G. Schwartz. The book is called At the Sands. I enjoyed it. I'm pretty sure Richard did too. We covered today about, I don't know, less than a fourth of it. If the history of Las Vegas and the Sands in particular is of interest to you, by all means, pick it up. You'll be glad you did. So at the end of our shows, we have a recommended section. So Richard, do you have anything for our audience today?
Oh yeah, I have a good one. So, in the past, I have recommended the writings of David Hill, who was one of the best gambling writers around today. He writes for the Ringer website, and he's been on our show talking about his book, The Vapors, about hot springs. Anyway, he has just started a new podcast, and the podcast is called Gamblers, and it's put out by the Ringer. And the first episode is about Gina Fiore, who was on our show as RX Gamble, a very much talked about episode. A lot of people bring up those episodes. So I think any of our listeners will definitely like this podcast. So check it out. It's called Gamblers, and it's at the Ringer.
So when are we going to be on that show, Richard? Either separately or non-separately?
Well, actually, I was on the show, and that's not why I'm recommending it, but I did have a couple of places during that episode with Gina where he had interviewed me.
Uh-huh. And he must have forgotten my email address. Okay, I'll get over it. So, Dave, do you have a recommended for our audience?
I do. First of all, I will second the recommendation for David Hill in his podcast. It's great stuff. I've got something that's not necessarily gambling related, but there's a new Netflix series called We Are the Champions. It is narrated by Rainn Wilson, who you might know as Dwight Schrute from The Office, or Harry Mudd from Star Trek Discovery, if that's your thing. And it's a fascinating show. It is about different competitions. So I'll tell you some of the competitions that they talk about. Cheese rolling, chili eating, fantasy hairstyling, yo-yo. My favorite, I haven't seen the episode yet, but dog dancing. And there's another one about frog jumping, which, of course, if you remember, Mark Twain celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County, I think it was.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen that yet, but I bet it's apparently people are doing this where they're – and people really get into the chili eating one I saw last night. It was incredible. So I would recommend that. It's just a very good. And maybe if they do a second season, they might do one on gamblers because it's fascinating.
And it's called We Are the Champions?
We Are the Champions, like the Queen song.
Great. I will definitely check that out.
We Are the Champions. Yeah, it's on Netflix. It just released this week.
Great.
And I also want to say – Rainn Wilson's narration is perfect, and the writing for it, the writer, you know, perfectly nailed his narrative voice. It's just such a good show.
Huh.
A couple weeks ago, one of our guests was Matthew Dix, and he told a story about Vietnamese arm wrestling underground in New York. That seems like it would really fit on the We Are the Champions show.
Yeah. Huh.
All right. Thank you, David Schwartz. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.